Rabbi Eliezer, yesterday in the Torah, we read about the horrible story of Cain and Abel. Two brothers, and yet Cain is jealous of Abel. He turns against him and he murders him. And immediately God turns to him and he says to him that the blood of your brother cries out to me from the earth that has absorbed it. Likewise, the Jewish Torah is unique in saying, Leviticus chapter 19, Lo sa'amod al dam reyacho, that you cannot stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. It's a little bit different to how the New Testament might say that we maybe should turn the other cheek, sometimes have to love our enemies. I have told my Christian friends that I'm not sure Jesus meant necessarily when it came to something like genocide, we should turn the other cheek. I think he probably meant in the face of petty slights, etc. So I have to put it to you, the question that is at the very center of tonight's discussion. Do the strong nations of this world have a responsibility to expend treasure and even blood to protect the weak?
One of the saddest stories in the Bible is really the story of Cain and Abel. And I wish we had more time. I will give you a lecture on it. It's one of my favorite things that I do. Give lectures on the Bible. After all, the text is so beautiful, so despairing, and so meaningful. There were only two brothers in the whole world. Two brothers, Cain and Abel. And one became the assassin or the victim of the other. Why? Why does the Bible begin its career with this story? It was troubling me for many, many, many years. I studied every single source. And then I came to the conclusion, actually, well, first of all, as you know, I love questions more than answers, but this question has to be at least addressed. Is it that all of us must learn that whatever happens, happens to us as well? Which means Cain and Abel were brothers. Whose brother am I? And that's my choice. I can say that Cain, because he was human, it was a human act. Therefore, he's my brother. Or I can say, oh, no. He's not my brother. He's my enemy. Abel is my brother. And so, what have you learned from modern history? We have learned, really, that it's possible for people who think that they are brothers and one becomes the enemy of the other. You know, I did not go to Rwanda for all kinds of reasons, but I did go years ago to Yugoslavia. At that time, that was in the news. Yugoslavia, where hundreds and hundreds of people killed one another every single day. And I would go there. I went literally from person to person, asking, why? Tell me why. Because in Yugoslavia, it was not strangers who were enemies, but people who knew one another, neighbors, sometimes cousins. Say, why do you do that? And I never had the answer. Usually they began and stopped in the middle of the sentence. To this day, I don't know what they would have said, but I saw them. And I remember if ever I had tears in my sleep, it was there in Yugoslavia. But day after day, I saw them. And says, therefore, but you say, Lo tamot al tam reyecha, one of the most beautiful sentences in the world, naturally, thou shalt not stand idly by. What are we doing as teachers, as writers, as humanists? Simply, they're not standing idly by. And the word idly is very powerful. Idly, don't stand idly by. Which means if you are there and something is happening, do something. Become a participant. Unfortunately, I belong to a generation that has seen the opposite. When we study our contemporary history books, what hurts is not so much, of course, that hurts more than anything in the world, the elements of the tragedy, but the indifference of the world. And we were convinced, I remember, in in Auschwitz. I was walking with my father, night of our arrival. When we spoke, I was convinced that all that was secret. Secret, behind and beyond mountains and walls, secret, that the world wouldn't accept it, would do something. Only afterwards, when I came to America and went to the libraries, the archives, and I realized that everything was known, that's when I got desperate. I felt Roosevelt, the great Roosevelt, the friend of the Jewish people, surely he doesn't know. And now we know everybody knew except the victims. And therefore, since then, because of those memories, whenever something happens in the world, which means when collectively or individually, people suffer or die, I feel it's our duty at least to raise our voice.
Excuse me, please. You know, here we are trying to talk about genocide and the slaughter of innocents, and how dare you interrupt it when so many innocent people have died in the 20th century. Can someone please tell this heckler that they should not disrupt the world, the face of the Holocaust to the world? Can someone please... Now, this is astonishing. We have Elie Wiesel speaking, whose birthday is tomorrow, his 85th birthday, thank God, and this man has absolutely no respect. How dare you? Professor Wiesel, you were saying that how surprised you were that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was beloved by the Jews, and who the Jews voted for, I'm just guessing, 90% of the time, and he ultimately did defeat the Nazis, but he failed, it seems, bombing the tracks to Auschwitz. The quota for German Jews at the time to enter the United States was 26,000 a year. Only one quarter of that quota was filled. Troop transports came back from Europe completely empty. They could have brought Jewish refugees. The St. Louis was turned away in 1939 from Cuba, but then it wasn't allowed to land in the United States. So are you saying that he failed to protect, to use his strength to protect the weak?
Roosevelt was our hero. In my town, I didn't know the name of David Ben-Gurion. I didn't. I was a yeshiva boy. I studied in the yeshiva, studying only Talmud, nothing else in the Bible. I didn't read newspapers. I didn't know. It's only when I came after the war that I realized who Ben-Gurion was. I didn't know the name. But I did know one thing, that Roosevelt is a friend of the Jewish people. And therefore we felt if all that would be true, he would know. And if he knows, he would do something. And only later, when I came to America and began going to libraries and studied, and he knew, Roosevelt knew. Look, he was a great man, a great leader. What he has done for America in those times will not be forgotten, of course not. But when it comes to Jewish suffering, to the Jewish tragedy, he did not win the test.
So as a war leader defeating the Nazis, he succeeded, but as someone who could have stopped the genocide, he failed.
Maybe not stop, but at least limited it.
Limited.
And at least spoken about it.
He never, in I think it was 900 press conferences during the war, he never once mentioned the slaughter of the Jews of Europe.
The Jewish tragedy was not mentioned. He mentioned the tragedies of victims, yes, but not mainly about the Jewish tragedy, he did not.
Okay, Mr. President, first of all, let me apologize for the rudeness of that person. You know what bothers me about a heckler like that? When your people were being slaughtered in 1994, all those people, I know some of them may have been too young, but they were silent. And now they all raise their voice. And there are controversies attached to your country, which we will later address. But we will address them amidst the knowledge that you saved your people from a genocide and saved them from mass slaughter. And it would have been nice that all these people who are critics of Rwanda, where were they all in 1994? The reason why I got to, Sheldon Adelson asked me today, Shmuley, why as a Jew are you so interested in the Rwandan genocide? And I said, because Sheldon, We Jews are the ones who proclaim to the world never again. We taught the world, thou shalt not stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. It's in our Bible. We gave the world the Ten Commandments, do not murder, and it has to apply to everybody, Jew and non-Jew alike. But in no genocide, with what Professor Wiesel said about what FDR did not do to save the Jews of Europe, although he did, thank God, stop the Nazis and that ultimately saved them, but that was so much more true of the slaughter of the Tutsis in Rwanda. The United States had just been spooked by Black Hawk Down, Somalia, in late 1993. They weren't going to do anything for Rwanda. And the history is terrible. It's almost shameful for this great nation that I love and of which I am a very proud citizen. President Clinton did not meet with his senior staff even once during the Rwandan genocide. He apologized for that when he came to your country in 1998. Susan Rice, our current national security advisor, actually said in a meeting that if they call the genocide a genocide, it'll affect Democrats in the congressional 1994 elections. That was written by Samantha Power, very dear friend, great woman, one of the foremost champions of fighting genocide, and she wrote that in her book, A Problem from Hell, and now Susan Rice is her colleague. I'm not trying to make anyone look bad, I'm just retelling the facts. The United States was asked to jam the RTLM antenna from which the genocide was being broadcast. Even to jam the antenna, you had advocates in the State Department saying that we can't mess with the Hutus' right to freedom of speech. When that freedom of speech was calling Tutsis cockroaches that had to be exterminated. So the question tonight is, do the strong have an obligation to protect the weak? And do you feel that obligation was met during the Rwandan genocide? And what should have been done?
Thank you. Many things were happening and were not happening at the same time. Others were not happening. But the genocide of 1994 has a history. It's not just that it erupted and happened. In fact, if you look just decades back, in, say, 1930s, we had on the hands of the Belgians, who were the colonial masters at the time, the population of Rwanda profiled and differentiated and taught to believe that they were different from each other, and on the same basis they should hate each other. That's how identity cards were issued that would show that one is a Hutu, another is a Tutsi, another is a Twa. In a community that is otherwise brought together by one culture, one language, the Rwandese culture. So there's that bit of history. So when it happened in 1994 and there was that slaughter going on, and we had that history brought out and explained and shown how that would result into people actually not only hating each other as they were taught, but to kill as we had in the form of genocide in 1994. So it was surprising that at that time it happened, the response, in fact, we used to have many telephone calls made to us from outside, from the countries, developed countries. The message was, try to restrain. That was to us, we who were trying to fight the genocide. And the question back to them was always, what do you mean? How? And the whole thing had been characterized as, you know, this is the usual, the common savage reaction by Africans killing one another. This is something we are used to. So it wasn't seen for what it was, a genocide of people killed for who they were, persecuted. No, it was right from the UN, including now the very people who had actually been associated with the history of profiling people to that extent. That it was just slaughter of one ethnic group by another, that would play out and that would be fine. But in actual fact, when you get to know the details, it was far worse than they were trying to put it. Like has been said already, the killings were not just along the ethnic lines, they just what they called ethnic, one ethnic group killing the other. Imagine in Rwanda we had, even along these lines, intermarriages. And we had people separating their own children in one family and some being killed because they looked like the group that was being persecuted and the others left by the parents. So the level of hatred had been pushed to a very high level to the extent that it really came out as insanity of some kind that people could do this. But then, from outside, when there was this kind of response of indifference, of saying, well, this is how it plays out in Africa with Africans, it's just one, what some would call them tribes, others ethnic groups, and it's like, well, we can have one kill the other, and it usually happens, and it would play out, and we would move on. But of course, we ourselves, the Rwandans, and especially those at the receiving end, could not see it that way, and could not accept it that way.
Well, the Rwandan genocide was different to the Holocaust in that, as Professor Wiesel just said, people could, they wanted to deny that the slaughter of European Jewry was happening insofar as there weren't cameras, television crews filming it. Rwanda, all of that existed, even though there were only 15 journalists because everyone, it wasn't an important story to them, but we did know what was happening. The UN pulled out its troops based, again, unfortunately, with the United States taking the lead and Kofi Annan not giving Romeo Dallaire any permission to stop the genocide, which he had requested to use his Belgian troops. Are you, and now President Clinton, who oversaw all this, is a close friend of yours. He made an apology. It took a lot of guts for a world leader to make an apology. He puts a lot of time in the Clinton Global Initiative to humanitarian work in Rwanda. He was there the day before I visited you in Kigali recently. Are you angry at the United States? Were you angry at the time? Did you say to yourself, this is a superpower that believes in freedom, democracy? Did you think we were hypocrites at the time, that we, that the United States was taking the lead at removing the UN mission, that the Clinton administration at the time would not even block the RTLM transmissions, and that we wouldn't even give African nations who wanted to go in and stop the genocide armored personnel carriers? We made them pay for them while they sat for a month in these negotiations. I mean, this is kind of hard to believe. Are you angry at the United States? Were you angry at the time? Were you angry at the world community for seeing your people slaughtered and doing nothing?
Issues of hypocrisy have been, relating to hypocrisy, have been abandoned before even the genocide happened, and more significant during the genocide. But one lesson we learned along the way was not to dwell so much on blaming others for what has happened or what has not happened, but to take responsibility for ourselves. Because, indeed, understanding this world... So we were so much angry at what was happening to us, irrespective of where they were or where that was coming from, and we focused our minds on saying, let's deal with the problem. Because if we had wasted time thinking about others, what they are able to do for us or what they are not able to do for us, we probably would not have even been able to bring that to an end, or we would have had double loss of what we actually did. Now,
you gave up on the world. You decided they're not trustworthy, that this whole thing of the strong protecting the weak is a myth, and that I can only protect my own people.
We took that lesson for granted long ago.
Do you still take that for granted? Do you believe today Rwanda has its critics? Is one of the reasons that Rwanda, and we'll get to a bit more in detail soon, mm-hmm. is one of the reasons Rwanda is controversial is that you maintain that attitude? You can all criticize me. I'm going to protect my people. I don't care what you say. You can hate me. You can heckle me. But I've learned already I can't rely on you. So to hell with your criticisms. I'm the president of Rwanda. My people experience a genocide. I have to protect them.
There is a very central element to do with that. You know, what we do, there's no doubt about it. And that lesson has come to stay with us because we see it every day from that time of 1994 up to this moment. We see it. We see it happen to us. We see it happen in other places. So, again, this is why I'm saying we try to do the best we can for ourselves. And in fact, even within our limited means, we try to do what we can for others in the same situation. We probably will come to that later on when I show you how we have been able to participate in peace support operations across the world, whether it is in Sudan or South Sudan or Haiti, or now we'll be participating in Mali. We've been doing that. And it stems from that kind of understanding of can we do something even for others, but certainly we concentrate on trying to make sure that our own situation is quite in order.
And doing something for others would include the Rwandan troops that are currently in Darfur protecting those who were being slaughtered in a genocide.
Absolutely.
5,000 Rwandan troops or so?
We have 4,000 in Darfur, and then we have 1,000 in South Sudan.
Which was on the front page of the New York Times yesterday. Okay, Mr. President. Rebbe Eliezer, isn't that similar to what Israel's attitude is today? The Jews were slaughtered en masse in the Holocaust. They couldn't get into Palestine because the British government closed the borders. One of the criticisms of FDR, again, is that he could have pressured Winston Churchill, who really needed him at the time, to open the doors of Palestine to Jewish refugees, but even that remained closed. They had nowhere to go. So the state of Israel has decided, you know what? Criticize us, condemn us. In a recent poll, Israel was the second most hated nation on earth. North Korea is the most hated. Then Israel, then Iran. So, interesting neighbors right there. But Israel's attitude is, you know, criticize us all you want. Where were you when we were being gassed at a rate of 10,000 a day, 1.5 million children? We had no army. Now we have an army and condemn us, but we're not going to walk. We're not going to do this again. We're going to protect ourselves. Because so many of the Jews feel, Rebbe Eliezer, that the silence in the face of the Holocaust was motivated by anti-Semitism. The world doesn't like Jews. Anti-Semitism is the perennial poison of the nations of the world. They're always hating the Jews, the Crusades, auto de fés, pogroms, and eventually the Holocaust. But now we're hearing from President Kagame that his nation experienced the same thing, and they're not Jewish. At least that I know of, Mr. President. So, Rebbe Eliezer, was the silence in the face of the Holocaust unique to the Jews as anti-Semitism? And does Israel therefore have the right to say, you guys will never understand us, you're always hostile to us, we're not even going to try to explain ourselves, and few countries in the world have as bad PR as Israel has today? Or is it just true that people are into their lives here in New York, they want to go bike riding in a beautiful Sunday afternoon like today, and they just don't really care who's dying, but there's no particular prejudice?
Well, you touch, of course, a topic which is very dear to us, topic of Israel. Israel plays a central role in our life, in mine actually. Had there been no Israel, you know, 70 years ago or so, I think the Jewish people would still be here. Now Israel is here, and I cannot imagine the Jewish people going on living without Israel. Israel now is part of our life, part of our hope. It's us. We don't live there. We are not subject to the fear that Israelis have occasionally, but nevertheless, Israel is part of our life. It's truly part of mine. My wife, my son, we go there very often because we cannot not go there. Now, what does it mean, really? Does it mean that all of a sudden we become overly nationalistic, super nationalistic? Not at all. It simply is that we claim a right over our history. It is because we study history, because we live history, that we feel we cannot allow now anything to happen to Israel. I repeat, if there had been no Israel 70 years ago, the Jewish people would be still. But there is Israel. Thank God. And therefore, we cannot imagine the Jewish people go on living without it. We can live far away from it, but not without it. And therefore, whenever anything happens in Israel, of course, we respond immediately. When there is a crisis, how many American young Jews go to Israel right away? Trying to enlist in the army, which is the most beautiful thing that you can say about American young people. But they go. But the same thing is true in France. Wherever I go, young people, when needed, they go to Israel. That is, of course, a cause, a kind of sacred cause for anyone who is Jewish or a friend of the Jewish people. So the question, therefore, is, what does it mean? What is the meaning of all that? This is a question that all philosophers ask. And I study philosophy and I teach philosophy, so I ask myself, what does it mean? What does it mean that the Jewish people went through so much and nevertheless has not lost its commitment to honor? With all the problems that Jewish people have, especially in Israel, after all, it's a political state as well. But nevertheless, they tried so hard for 2,000 years to change us. Maybe it didn't change. And nothing will make us change. We are here to stay who we are. But what does it mean, therefore? Are we really what is written? We are the witnesses to the world. Everyone is a witness to one another. But only in the Bible is Kedim Atem Ladoshem. You are my witnesses. I'm sure you remember the commentary in the Bible. The Midrash says, God says, if I am your God, I am your witness. But if I am not, and you are not my witnesses, I am not God. God speaking like that, I am God because you are my witnesses. So for us, therefore, the term witness is very important, not only religiously, but also historically. Who are our witnesses? During the war, since you mentioned, of course, we asked, who were our witnesses? Was it Roosevelt? Roosevelt was a very great leader. Really a great leader. America was blessed with having him as a leader. Except when it came to the Jewish cause. But he was a great leader of America. He led the world, the free world, into war against Hitler. How can we forget that? What does it mean to us, therefore, today? We live in America. Or in France, or in England, wherever Jews are. I believe that we must be open not only to our own past and present, but to other people's as well. Therefore, when things happen in Rwanda, of course I responded right to them, naturally, or anywhere else, certainly. How can I not? I would be able to look into the mirror if I were not at least raise my voice. I remember during the war I went to Yugoslavia. At that time, that was the center, not Africa. And I remember I would go there because, and I would go from house to house asking, tell me, why do you hate your neighbor? There was hatred there, really hatred. Sometimes not only neighbors, but cousins. Not strangers didn't hate one another. Those who knew one another. I went from one to the other saying, why? Tell me why. No one knew. But they hated. Then I realized hatred can be without any cause. What do we do? At least to unmask hatred. And when you see hatred, at least you or I must ask, why do you really hate?
Well, Eliezer, one of the things that I want to talk to you about, given the time of this evening, is one of the disagreements, the only disagreement that you and I have ever had, and who has the chutzpah to disagree with Elie Wiesel. But you don't believe that we should hate evil, and I think we should hate evil, the evil people, because we won't fight them otherwise. I'll get to that in just a moment. But, okay, so I think we heard from President Kagame and Professor Wiesel that the strong do have an obligation to protect the weak. Mr. President, you've expressed your cynicism that they could be relied upon, and you think that people have to be much more independent in protecting themselves, and that's the posture you've adopted as the leader of your country. And, Rabbi Eliezer, you also agree that the strong have an obligation to protect the weak, and you're kind of disappointed that even some of the great leaders, and you're praising Roosevelt, but amidst that, you're very disappointed at what he did not do, even a great man like him, who cared. Let's bring it to the current situation. And I'll turn to you again, Rabbi Eliezer, for a moment. In 2010, President Obama was putting a lot of pressure on Israel about settlements in Jerusalem. You took out full-page ads in the world's leading publications, and you said that Jerusalem appears 600-odd times in the Hebrew Bible. It doesn't appear in the Quran, and the president should understand our attachment to Jerusalem. And the president invited you to lunch. He's a dear friend of yours, President Obama. He has great respect for you, and I believe it's reciprocal. Will you, since the strong have an obligation to protect the weak, are you now going to speak out, let's say, about Iran and the president's overtures to Iran? That they have yet to call back their annihilatory, genocidal rhetoric against Israel. I know it was Ahmadinejad, and this is a new president, but he has yet to renounce it and say that's a bunch of claptrap, and he has yet to renounce the funding of Hamas and Hezbollah. And given that you're one of the most authoritative moral voices in the entire world, and those ads may have changed President Obama's posture towards Jerusalem. He invited you to lunch, and then it changed. That's the authority you carry. Will you be saying something about Iran now that an Israeli prime minister is arriving tomorrow with the threat of genocide still against Israel from Iran without that being removed? And again, now Prime Minister Netanyahu arrives. He's on the defensive yet again. The New York Times today front page is about how Netanyahu can be seen as a warmonger if he doesn't get with the new approach that people want peace and they want to see reconciliation. What is your attitude about the overture to Iran amidst this genocidal rhetoric toward Israel?
I'm against it, naturally. Of course. But look, I speak to people. I speak to leaders all over the world. And about Iran, I have done a lot. I cannot tell you what, because it's always personal, but I have done a lot. I believe Iran is a danger. Not only because Iran has, I don't even know why, become the enemy of Israel. I don't know why. Maybe they don't know why. They needed an enemy, they chose Israel. But they are an enemy, no doubt. And I spoke to many leaders of the world on that. But you can imagine what I said. The problem is, look, in this world, two categories of people have power. Politics, or finances. I'm not involved in politics, and I'm very poor in finances. So therefore, if they listen because I spoke and I speak, it's because it's not right not to listen to me. So they listen to me. But I know very well, the moment I leave them, they go on to the next item. And therefore, I need a lot not to become cynical. I need a lot of work on myself not to become cynical. Because it's so easy. It's not nice not to take a telephone call from me. It's not nice something. But I know very well that my influence is so weak. My impact is almost non-existent.
I saw the change in policy after the full-page ads you took out in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, countless other publications. So let me just put it straight to you, if you don't mind, Rabbi Eliezer, because of the gravity, the enormity of the question. Do you believe that the United States should be negotiating with Iran before they renounce those genocidal aspirations? officially renounce that and say that is not the policy of this government. It has no desire to destroy the state of Israel.
Absolutely. I think America should adopt a very harsher line, more truthful line, and say to Iran, look, you cannot continue like that. Not with our consent. You cannot. But maybe they do that. I hope they do. We don't know it, but they do.
Okay, President Kagame, look, as the only man alive to have stopped the genocide, your voice also is critical, which is why you're here. And we're very grateful. You're so busy during UN week. The president came all the way back from Canada and Rwanda Day in Toronto yesterday just to be here for this forum. Spoke at the UN on Wednesday as a world leader. What about genocides that are taking place in other areas? And by the way, I'm well aware of the fact that me and John Prendergast, who we're very honored to have here tonight, one of the world's foremost anti-genocide campaigners from the Enough Project, he and I were talking before. Genocide is defined as a focus specifically on race, religion, or ethnicity. So Syria may not be considered a genocide because Bashar Assad seems to want to kill anyone who's going to oppose his rule as opposed to any particular ethnic group. But we in our country are debating this question now, what should be done in Syria? It's off the news a little bit because our government may not exist tomorrow as of midnight. But if we have a government, we're debating this question about Syria because 1,500 children were gassed, 100,000 people were killed. And I know that you have a close relationship with President Obama, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot about this, but again, if it's not people like you and Professor Wiesel who speak out about the slaughter of innocents, what do we do about something like Syria, where poison gas is used? Is that a trigger for genocide? RTLM was broadcasting this cockroach stuff day in and day out, and it was a trigger for genocide. And then suddenly all they needed was one trigger, the assassination of President Habyarimana, and suddenly a genocide begins. And most accounts, of course, are that he was shot down by his own people in order to trigger that genocide by Hutu extremists who rejected the Hutu moderates. So are you concerned about the use of poison gas in Syria? Do you feel the obligation as a world leader to speak out and say something? Because what confuses me, and I'm not trying to even be objective here, because I don't feel when it comes to genocide one can be, or mass murder one can be objective, we had this terrible shooting in Newtown, Connecticut in December where 20 children, 6 teachers were murdered by Adam Lanza. He then shot himself. Had he said, okay, I surrender to the police and I'll give up my arsenal, he still would be punished. Even if you give up your chemical weapons, you still can't kill children. What is your opinion as someone who stopped the genocide as to what should happen in Syria?
See, these situations are very complex. Some things are not very clear or straightforward as hard or seen on the surface of it. But one thing is very clear. Poison gas should not be used anywhere against anybody. I wish we didn't even have them in stock anywhere in this world.
That's I'm going to clap for that.
But we have to deal with the world that we have and things that are there. In the case, say, of Syria, or even in many other cases, there are two things maybe one needs to look at, whether they happen at the same time, but it's one that has to happen. If a genocide is taking place or killings are taking place anywhere, even before you really understand or get to the bottom of why the killings are happening, you quickly think about how do we stop the killings? Because that's what is immediate. You've got to stop the loss of lives. As you do that, or even after doing that, if it is possible, then you can go into these details that will lead you to understanding other things that could be done or the actual basis why the killings were taking place and why this was. Because if you wait to first understand why the killings are going on and let the killings go, by the time you get to understand why the killings are going on, maybe you will have
isn't it important to punish someone who does those killings? I know that American public opinion...
Absolutely. There has to be a level of accountability. In fact, a very strong level of accountability. But you have to be clear about who is doing that. Because at times you can have so many sides saying, no, it's the other one, the other one says it's the other one. So you've got to be clear. Because you may take action. By the time you are done with the action or in the middle of it, you find actually you left the one who was responsible free. So this is why it has a sense of urgency involved. But it also has to be fact-based. You have to be clear about who is doing it and are there facts for that. It doesn't have to take long. You see, the issue is people are hard-pressed because of how long it takes to do what needs to be done to stop such tragic situations. But if people can get to the bottom of what exactly is happening and by who, the question of responsibility and accountability thereof is not to be put into question.
In Syria, we know exactly who did it. I know that President Putin still isn't sure, but in any event, he told me I'm not exceptional, so I take issue with his comments about me as an American. But we know exactly. What? Not yet. No. But thank you. Not yet, because we started a little bit late. We know exactly who did it. So should President Assad be punished for using poison gas against children and his people?
If people are sure, there should be no question of delay, of prolonged debate while the suffering goes on, or while somebody who actually committed such a heinous crime is enjoying liberty. Some level of accountability has to be put in place.
Abeliezer, what do you think about Syria? Should we punish Assad for gassing children? And for us Jews, gas, of course, has the worst possible connotation.
Here I feel very bad about our own leadership. Jewish leadership, the moment we knew that they are using gas, should have organized a mass demonstration of 500,000 people in the streets, go to Washington and say, this is beyond, enough, that we cannot take. Gas, when we know what was done with gas to our people a few generations ago, when that came out, there should have been a reaction, a very powerful reaction, and organize really something that should force the world to stop and say, hey, wait, it's true. Gas that we cannot take, we can't allow, we can't accept. But if you came with something like that, okay, it's one day's news, next day don't talk about it. Where is memory? Where is sensitivity? But it's responsibility. So here I'm afraid our leadership was not on the level. I expected more. It can be done in 24 hours.
So you think both the Jewish leadership and the American political leadership should be held accountable for not doing enough to punish Assad for using chemical gas?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think, is chemical gas a trigger for genocide? Do we have to now be concerned that this is a genocide trigger in Syria?
Well, genocide, I don't like to use a word like that because who knows what it is. 1,000 is genocide. 10,000, yes. 1,000, no. Let's not go into etymology here. But the fact is, gas. Gas has been used for the first time, and therefore it cannot be used again. And those who use it again should be, I think, arrested, imprisoned, charged with we'll find something for it. Anyway, something must be done. We cannot let it happen like that without reaction.
Mr. President, you know, I sometimes feel that the Rwandans are the Jews of Africa. There are so many similarities, some of them very unfortunate, between your people and the Jewish people. You, first and foremost, the fact that you experienced the genocide, of course. Second, that the UN seems very unfairly critical of your country, which is par for the course of the State of Israel. Many of us in the Jewish community don't have a lot of respect for the UN. It's humanitarian work, of course. It's outstanding, and I've seen it around the world. But in terms of UN Security Council resolutions, Israel seems to get the majority of the criticism when it's the only democracy in the Middle East, etc. Your government is getting a lot of the same animosity from France, which has been ongoing towards your country, which Israel has at times experienced as well. And there are many other similarities. So your solidarity with Israel and the Jewish people is important, given that you have a unique understanding of the kind of security concerns that Israel has. I mean, the kind of criticism that you're getting, like from hecklers and others about Eastern Congo, and I still want to address that, has a lot to do with the fact that the FDLR, a terrorist group comprised of former genociders, are on your border, and you feel the need to fight them. There was a grenade thrown in a public space just before I arrived in Kigali that killed a few innocent civilians. And Israel also had a buffer zone in southern Lebanon until a few years ago because of terrorist organizations like Hezbollah that kill innocent Israelis. In light of that, since you're opening an embassy in Israel, and that was announced through your foreign minister at an event that we hosted, and I thank Louise also for her friendship to Israel, is there no possibility of the country of Rwanda having this unique understanding of Israel's security situation and vice versa? And you were one of the only heads of state to really be invited, along with President Clinton, to President Peres' 90th birthday party. And you sat right there next to President Peres, President Clinton, Barbara Streisand, famous Jewish singer. Is there no possibility that you might consider opening your embassy specifically in Jerusalem to show solidarity with the Jewish state, given how maligned it can be and given how you yourself understand... Given, Mr. President, that you yourself must be astonished at the kind of attacks lodged against you when the world was so silent while your people died and you rescued them. And you understand us in a way that only you can, and we understand you in a way that only we can, and that would be a courageous step to have your embassy, which is about to be opened, in the Israeli eternal capital of Jerusalem, as opposed to Tel Aviv, which is a beautiful, you know, your ambassador will have great times at the beach. But... But is that a possibility, Mr. President?
I think there is no question about the similarities of histories of our two peoples, with a lot of, you know, things happening at differently or at different times and different places, but the feel and the feelings we have for the situation, and I guess the other way around, is not again in question. And for us, we feel very strong about relating to the Jewish people and to Israel, and we want to achieve that, and we have already had it moving quite well. In terms of relationship, we want to strengthen that. Therefore, the sense of urgency is about strengthening that and putting an embassy in Israel. We want to open an embassy in Israel. Now, the question is more specific. It's about doing it in a certain way, which you have mentioned. It's important, well, one has to know what does it mean. What does it mean? Sometimes you may do. Because, and why you are raising it is because it has issues around it that you are debating, or that are being debated, even though not necessarily by the Jewish state itself, but in a much wider context. So I would prefer that I move step by step. There is the relationship between Rwanda and Israel that we are happy with. There is opening an embassy so that is strengthened. That's my desire, that's our desire. Going another mile, to be specific with what you have mentioned, I would rather we don't make it too much of a hot subject at this moment. Okay. And we just look at it another time.
Well, when about 2 months ago, the Adelsons were made honorary citizens of Jerusalem, and my wife Debbie and I were there. And Mary announced that they wanted to buy a place in Jerusalem. And you're not going to be able to use it the entire time, Mary, so maybe you can loan it to the Rwandan embassy to stay there part of the time so we can, so the president can take these steps. Or we can put the embassy in an RV and actually move it from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. One of the most important questions that I have to ask, and we are going to be taking questions from the audience, and I'm sorry for a bit of the delay, ladies and gentlemen, but we started a little bit late. Rabbi Eliezer, Holocaust denial. What is that? I mean, so the new president of Iran says that the Holocaust actually did happen. You know, New York City exists. Thank you. And that's a phenomenal concession to this arch enemy of the Jewish people, Ahmadinejad, a modern-day Haman, committed to our extermination and destruction. But where did this even come from? I was at Oxford when David Irving, world-renowned historian, gets up and denies the Holocaust, a world-renowned historian. And now Rwanda is experiencing the same thing. You all need to know that this event was jeopardized by critics of the Rwandan government. Again, you saw one of them, who condemned President Kagame for the security actions he takes against to protect his people. In the letter that was sent to some of the participants not to participate, the person who's won some international humanitarian prizes denied the Rwandan genocide. He said in the letter that it wasn't Tutsis that were slaughtered, it was Hutus and Tutsis both died. It was a civil war. Jews and Germans both died in the Second World War. By the way, you were all aware of the fact that 12 million Germans did die in the Second World War, 6 million troops, about 6 million civilians. There is a little bit of a difference in that the Jews were targeted for gassing as a genocide. So they deny the Holocaust, they deny the Rwandan genocide. And it seems that the reason is that if there's no genocide of the Jews, then Israel shouldn't be so paranoid about its security concerns and it delegitimizes Israel's security actions. And the same thing is true with President Kagame. If you had no genocide, then you're just being a little bit extreme in the steps you're taking, and it's easy to delegitimize your government. Rebbe Eliezer, you're a professor at a world-renowned university. You speak to academic audiences everywhere. You know facts from fiction. How could this possibly happen in our time? The Holocaust denial is growing and growing. And Ahmadinejad, up until this year, came every year to the rostrum of the UN, who allowed him to deny the murder of the 6 million.
Whenever he would come to New York, he spoke inside the UN, and I spoke outside the UN. We always organize something. Say always, the same time. He went to speak, I spoke. Well, what I said, you can imagine. It's easier to believe that it didn't happen. It would be so much easier. You would sleep better. That the whole thing was actually a dream or a nightmare, but it didn't happen. Because no matter what, any intelligent person, any person who has some sense of education, a sense of history, knows. But that event was so uniquely unique in its intent, in its scope, in its intensity, and in its result, after all. And therefore, if anyone had told me, let's say, immediately after the war, that one day I will have to fight, simply to say, yes, it happened and I was there, I wouldn't have believed it. But these days, more and more Holocaust deniers appear everywhere in the world. And there are people who believe them. It's easier to think it's only a nightmare or an invention or simply a kind of story invented by Jews to get better attitudes to Israel. But it's happening. And it happened to me in some universities when somebody got up and said, hey, Professor Wiesel, but you know, many people say it's a lie. It never happened. What do you do? What do you do then? So therefore, look, what can we do? We cannot lower our level of intelligence or of delicacy or of humanity
and go down on the level of the Holocaust deniers. Which means I would never argue with the Holocaust denier. He's unworthy of a dialogue. I would never dialogue with the Holocaust denier.
And Mr. President, I'm amazed at the cottage industry of genocide deniers who are growing up around Rwanda. So given that there are those who are trying to deny one of the most established and tragic facts of modern history, and I believe the purpose is to delegitimize your government, let's just immediately address some of the criticisms that in your effort to protect your people, that you are supporting the M23 in Eastern Congo. The FDLR is operating there, and I understand they are former genocide dares. They are a terrorist organization. I was in Tanzania recently when there was a kerfuffle between you and the president of Tanzania because he suggested you should be speaking to the FDLR, and I understand how offended you were by that, because if someone told Prime Minister Netanyahu tomorrow, Tuesday, when he comes to speak at the UN, that he should be negotiating with Hamas, whose charter calls for the murder of every Jew everywhere in the world, including here in the United States, he would likewise be offended. But what about the allegations that Rwanda, you're a hero to so many around the world. You've stopped the genocide. But they're saying that you are now supporting grotesque human rights violations in Eastern Congo, with the M23 drafting child soldiers guilty of rape and the slaughter of civilians, and that the motivation of Rwanda is not to protect itself from another genocide, but rather to get hold of some of Congo's mineral wealth, which seems to be a lot more in Eastern Congo than in Rwanda. How would you respond to that, Mr. President?
Well, I start simply from the premise. One, I want to be very clear. Protect our people, I will. We will protect our people. That's fine. Number two, the issue of M23, the issue of Eastern Congo, is just a red herring. It doesn't have much to do with the problem of genocide. It has more to do with the failed state that Congo is and has been for many years. M23 is not something that erupted just last year, 2012. It has a history. And the history and the facts relating to that are embedded in the situation in Congo, not in Rwanda. In fact, you would get the correct picture from even the way it is distorted. It's surprising even for the person who was hearing from the crowd. Does anybody think that Congo has no problems other than those that originate from Rwanda? Because this is what the issue is portrayed as. M23, let me give you an example, is in the northern part of Eastern Congo, which is called Kivu, North Kivu. You know the geography, probably, and the history of that area very well. But problems of Congo happen every day in the whole of Congo that have no relationship with what is happening in North Kivu. So, which shows you that the problem is countrywide, it's across the country. It has nothing to do with that specific part. It has a long history. The army, the institution of army in Congo, is known for rape, for pillage, for murder. It has never been known to do what an army does of any country. Now, all of a sudden, in that situation, the bad guys are people called M23. I will come to the history of that a little bit. So, and everything, rape, murder, pillage, that have happened over the years across the country are absorbed in that situation of North Congo of M23. This is the double standards and hypocrisy we are talking about. There is a UN force in the Congo that has been there for over 10 years. It spends $1.5 billion every year, right? Not a single person, whether it is that person would come from the UN or from anywhere, would tell us that this is what we have to show for UN's presence or that expense. I mean, what is this kind of world that does not have any level of accountability, to the point that even what brought this whole force, it's about 18,000 troops, there is not a single thing, not one. People can point to and say, this is what they have done, this is the improvement they have brought to the country for all the time they have been there. So it becomes simpler, therefore, to say, no, the problems must be coming from somewhere else. Everybody rallies to blame somebody outside of the situation. Now, why shouldn't the government of Congo ever be held accountable for its problems? Why shouldn't the UN that has 18,000 troops that spends $1.5 billion in the Congo be held accountable to tell this world that spends that money on that force what they do in the Congo? Why can't the army that I have described to you of Congo be held accountable for what they have done over the years? So what is this M23 issue that has come to be associated with Rwanda and to absorb every problem in that situation? And what is very surprising, you find it's with the nations, it's with UN, it's with the media, it's with everybody. I don't want to believe that people across the world are this naive or cannot see what is on the ground. I have asked these particular questions because they're important. Meaning, when you read all the papers, whether here in the United States or Europe or wherever, they're not talking about the problems of Congo in the context of Congo as a country and holding responsible the leaders of that country. They are always pointing to Rwanda. In fact, some people who are ignorant will confuse Rwanda for Congo. This is exactly what...
Congo is 20, 30 times the size, probably?
It's more than 100, probably. Yes. In fact, I have told this not only to the leaders of Congo, but to other leaders that we discuss these issues. I have told them that I think, on one hand, Congo's leaders are very lucky, but on the other, they are really very unlucky. They are lucky because nobody ever asks them for accountability for their own country and what they do for their country.
Well, maybe it's a compliment.
It's Rwanda.
But maybe it's a compliment to you. In the same way Israel is judged by a higher standard because people believe that Israel is a very educated, democratic, highly civilized nation. They expect it. They judge it by a higher standard. That might be a compliment. They know that you ended a genocide.
I think it is a higher
standard.
It is a misplaced compliment, in my view. Yes, I don't want any compliments for what is happening or what is not happening elsewhere.
Right. Well, in this world, I guess you got to be happy for any kind of compliments we get. So, Reverend Ezra, the final question I want to put to you, and I mentioned it before. The only thing I've ever disagreed with you on, and you have inspired so much of what I've done in my life, particularly my belief that the true response to the question of where is God when people suffer is that we don't want to know where he is. We have a right to challenge God and be angry at God and demand accountability, strange as it may sound, even from God. That the word Israel means he who wrestles with God, he who struggles with God. You have given humanity a voice in the face of God's omnipresence. We are not just cosmic chaff who are worthless and valueless, and God is always right, and we're always sinful, and we deserve to get smashed and killed because of our sins. I reject that. I think humanity is good, by and large. But because of that, and you've given us that voice, that's a singular achievement that harkens back to Moses and Abraham, who did the same, speaking back to God. But yet, you believe we have no right to hate evil. And that's something you and I discussed. You said to me, Shmuley, we can't hate evil because if we do, we will internalize it. And then it'll become part of our constitution and our makeup. But Rebbe Eliezer, what am I supposed to feel towards genocidaires in Rwanda? The woman who I met when I was in Kigali, Mr. President, recently, whose husband was shot in the head in her house, and whose two children, they were babies, had their heads cracked against a wall in front of her face and then gang raped her by 20 men. And she said to me that she had not allowed a man to touch her in 18 years because she cannot believe that men are gentle. What am I supposed to feel towards men like that if not hatred? How could I be neutral? Miriam Adelson's entire family was wiped out. So many family, her mother's family, wiped out. What am I supposed to feel towards the SS? Towards the Nazis, towards the people who murdered your family. You know, the most powerful line I think I've ever read in world literature is the line that is now at the entrance of the U.S. Holocaust Museum. And it comes from your book, Night, that when you saw that child who was, I think, smuggling food in just to feed, I think, his father, and he was hung by his neck, you said that you saw God hanging from that tree. What a line, God Almighty. Why should I not hate people who could do that? How will I fight them if I don't hate them? Isn't there a place for hatred of evil?
Why not? If that's what makes you who you are, okay, I'm not fighting hatred. I simply don't believe in it. I believe that other ways. Hatred is too easy almost. What do you do with it? Okay, you hate, and then what? I wish I could. But I was, let's say, inside those places. Did I hate the SS? I could never look at them. They were not allowed to look at an SS. How can I hate somebody whom I don't see? Second, it would limit the depth of the experience. Because once you hate, then the chapter is closed. But the chapter is not closed. Some of us who were there, for us, it lives to this day. In our sleep, in our dreams, and in our commitments. It's here. Without hate. Anger, absolutely. I believe in anger. Creative anger. A good anger. But hatred has a dynamic. Once somebody starts hating, hatred doesn't stop. It spreads. It goes from A to B to C, it goes. It's not a static thing. And therefore, I'm not worried. If somebody says, nevertheless, I hate, I'm not even trying to convince, because who am I? I feel it's not my life, it's not my way of dealing with history or with my experiences. No. Once you say hatred is not the answer, then you ask, well, what is the answer? And there, I say, okay, then now let's go and study.
We're not going to go to questions from the audience. Maybe I shouldn't have disagreed with Elie Wiesel. And following that, please, everyone, remain seated because this evening is going to conclude with closing remarks from Mr. Michael Steinhardt, the creator of the most successful Jewish educational program in the history of the world, Birthright Israel. I know there are so many participants who are here, including my own kids. And then we have a special presentation to make this evening. So We're going to go to the questions, and again, because the speaker is going to leave before one else does, so everyone please remain seated. Yes, the Secret Service is here, so be very careful.
Well, we have you. Actually, the students who RSVP'd for tonight had submitted questions along with their RSVP, and so there's going to be one question for President Kagame and the other for Mr. Elie Wiesel. For President Kagame, the question is, to what extent do you feel that Rwanda's post-genocide transition can serve as a model for other nations emerging from civil conflict? That is, what has Rwanda done which can be a model for others?
Right. I think I say it in relation to the last question which was asked to me. One way of protecting people is to invest in them and strengthen their capacity to deal with any adversity. And that's what we have concentrated on doing. That's why we have invested heavily in education, in health, in food security, in many things that simply make people feel they are on the path and they are participating in what meets their aspirations of being who they are and therefore enjoying the freedom of that without any threat from either within or from outside. So what we do is share experiences with other people. It's about, in fact, people have been wondering, they've seen where we have come from 20 years ago to date, and it's like, they wonder what has happened. But we tell them, and people have been coming from across Africa to study what, how we have been doing, what we have been doing, and why, and how we make the progress we are making. But one thing other than showing them what we've been doing, which may mirror what they can do in their own places or not, we tell them that if we can do it, you can do it.
And I saw it with my own eyes, Mr. President.
So
really what you've built in Rwanda is
remarkable.
We have a question
for Mr. Wiesel. The question is, every country only has a finite number of resources. How can a government strike the balance between looking after its own citizens, which many argue are its primary concern, and helping the global community at large? Where is that balance?
Look, the main purpose is to believe that we are not alone here. I am not alone. Not only because, thank God, I have a family, but I am not alone in the world. God alone is alone. Man is not. And therefore, I must be ready to deal not with my loneliness, but with my fellow man's loneliness. There is one sin that I refuse, is to allow another person who suffers to think that nobody cares. That's the worst that can happen. That person is suffering or being persecuted or being tormented and tortured, and nobody cares. That is my fault. If I don't speak up and I don't take his hand, her hand, it's my fault. I think that is the basic principle of morality, to think of the otherness of the other. That person has the right, the same right that I have to be who I am, is to be who he or she is. And that is a lesson. But otherwise, why are we doing what we are doing, those of us who went through all that? Look, we could have very well decided after the war, look, we have given enough. We have done enough. We have suffered enough. And now please leave me alone. Don't talk to me about other people's suffering.
I don't want to compare. So leave me alone. We have all the right to say that. And no one would have had the right to question our resolution. But we have not done that. Quite the opposite. Those who came out from all those infamous places, all of them, at least in my field, I was in Paris, then in France, they became doctors, they became lawyers, they worked for humanity, they worked for the other, they worked for the country, they worked for the world. I cannot imagine my life if it was simply my own life and nobody else's. It has nothing to do with anyone. In that form, then why should I? Why should I teach? Why should I write? Why should I be here? To suffer is a personal attitude to accept that suffering. But the suffering of the other is something else. I can say I suffer, it's my right. But I cannot accept the suffering of another person. And that we call